Tiger!
Ora, ora.
Hello, I'm Hanea Ahu, bringing you The Week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Resh Lyon. Parliament's been adjourned for a week, a short break before a solid 4 weeks going through to the first week in April, right up to Easter. Good Friday is on April the 3rd this year, and the House is set to adjourn on Thursday evening, April the 2nd. Then, after Easter, they have 4 weeks off, resuming in the final week of April on Tuesday the 28th. But back to the present, and we'll be joining the MPs in the debating chamber for this Tuesday's question time. First, though, with a report on the past week, including the only select committee meeting and some interesting insights into parliamentary arithmetic from political scientist Nigel Roberts. Here's Tom Fruin.
There was just the one select committee meeting during the week. That was the Māori Affairs Committee, which travelled north for 2 days of hearings. The first on Monday was in Kaitaia, where committee members heard submissions on the Te Hiku Claim Settlement Bill. Then on Tuesday, the committee met in Auckland to hear submissions on another Treaty Claim Settlement Bill for one of the older Tamaki tribes, Te Kawaro Amaki. Then it was on to the Māori Language Te Reo Māori Bill, with submissions revealing a sharp division between urban and rural iwi. Resh Lyon reports on that, and we'll also be talking to political scientist Nigel Roberts about the potential impact on numbers in the House after the Northland by-election, plus some updates on final deadlines for submissions on inquiries and bills. First, though, here's Resh Lyon on the road with the Māori Affairs Select Committee.
The Māori Language Te Reo Māori Bill is focused on the continuing revitalisation of Te Reo Māori and seeks to repeal the Māori Language Act 1987 and Part 4A of the Broadcasting Act 1989 in order to establish an independent entity, Te Matawai, to provide leadership on behalf of iwi and Māori regarding the health of the Māori language. Making a submission on the bill in Auckland on Tuesday was broadcaster and former MP Willie Jackson, now chairman of the National Urban Māori Authority.
We see the bill as a betrayal of urban Māori from the previous Minister of Māori Affairs. And he has come up with a bill that is totally against the interests of Māori in Auckland.
The former minister Willie Jackson was referring to there was former Māori Party co-leader and Māori Affairs Minister Peter Sharples.
How he came up with it and why he came up with it is beyond me and beyond us, given the Māori language renaissance started at marais like his. The revival, the Māori renaissance, wasn't started in the heart of Ngāpuhi or Tainui or Ngāti Porou, but it was started at urban marais like Hoani Waititi. And for some reason, the former minister forgot all that and got all romantic and decided that the tribes deserved this right to lead this kaupapa, despite the type of kōrero that came from has come from some of our rangatira in the reo, like Timothy Karetu, who said, why should the language be returned to the control of the same iwi who let it die?
Mr. Jackson questioned the bill's underlying intention that the future implementation of Te Reo revitalisation should be led by iwi.
Tribes don't have any right to this kaupapa. The reality is that this kaupapa was driven by our practitioners in the city, by the karetus also, the academics who worked with our people at the coalface, advanced this kaupapa when tribes left the language to die. So it's saddening to see what's happened, and it's particularly sad that we've been cut out and totally left out of the equation.
Chairman of the National Urban Māori Authority, Willie Jackson. And later there was a submission from a representative from the rural Northland iwi, Ngāti Hine, Waharoa Shortland.
I'm sitting here, my generation, a product of parents who made sure that 100% of us who came through in my time were speakers of Māori. Those numbers are nearly flipped around today. Our figures are almost no different from the rest of the country, demographics as far as it is concerned. So we are passionate that we have to be engaged in that process. It's not going to be achieved by putting another level of overlords over what is already being well catered for, we believe.
Mr. Shortland welcomed the inclusion of iwi as leaders of a Māori language strategy, but questioned the establishment of a governing board in order to implement it.
I hate the thought that all we're pushing for in these new structures is just another way for another group of people to gather up funding streams towards themselves or towards a kaupapa over here, and then we'll mix it all up, and before you know it, you don't know where it went. I say let the people who say iwi can't do it, watch us.
Ngāti Hine representative Waharoi Shortland with that submission on the Māori Language Bill to the Māori Affairs Committee in Auckland on Tuesday.
Rhys Lyon, and he'll be back in conversation with Nigel Roberts, Professor Emeritus at Victoria University, and one of a fairly rare breed. He's a cephologist, an expert in elections and election results. With our MMP electoral system, numbers in the House are set by the party vote in the general election. But what happens when that proportionality is altered by a by-election? If National's former Northland MP Mike Sabin is not replaced by another National member, does National get another list MP to maintain the party's strength at 60 seats as determined in the general election, or does National drop back to 59 seats? And what effect might that have on the arithmetic in the debating chamber? Rhys Lyon asked Nigel Roberts to explore the possibilities arising from the Northland by-election later this month.
Well, there are two possibilities. The one possibility is that National wins the seat, and then National would revert to having 60 seats in Parliament, because National currently has only 59 seats in Parliament. It won 60 seats as a result of the size of its party vote in the general election, and about two-thirds of those are electorate seats, and the remainder of the list are list seats. However, if they lose the by-election, that means National would stay at 59 seats, and whoever won, I'm assuming that the most likely potential winner other than National would be Winston Peters, that Winston Peters would then be entitled to resign his position as a list MP, take up the position as the MP for Northland, and then would be able to fill that vacant list seat with another New Zealand First seat. So it would increase the number of New Zealand First seats to 12 from the 11 that they now have in Parliament as a result of the results of the last election, which would slightly change the composition of the governing forces, because at the moment we have a government with 59 seats, plus hoping to get one back, make it 60, and then confidence and supply agreements with four other members of Parliament, the ACT MP, the United Future MP, and the two Māori Party MPs. So it gives the government a fairly comfortable buffer in Parliament, but as we've seen, the confidence and supply agreements does not compel individual members of those three parties, the ACT Party, United Future and the Māori Party, to vote for the government other than on confidence and supply and on matters related to the ministerial portfolios they hold. So we've seen, for example, Peter Dunn make some very negative comments about the proposal to amend the Resource Management Act. Now, if the Māori Party and Peter Dunn don't support the Resource Management Act, and National has only 59 seats, plus David Seymour of ACT 60, you could have 61 votes against the Resource Management Act, as you did in the last Parliament.
What about Labour? What would happen if Labour happened to win that seat?
Well, if Labour won the seat, they likewise would then pick up an extra member of Parliament, and so that they would go from 32 seats in Parliament to 33 seats in Parliament. And of course, in Labour's case, there is no doubt that they would pick up that seat, because there's been some doubt. Winston Peters has been, as he generally tends to do, a little bit coy on the question of what he would do if he won Northland. Of course, National's trying to taunt them, wow, are you going to bring in a new member from Invercargill? Of course, Winston Peters would be the MP for Northland. I mean, I think that that's a somewhat of a straw person, but There would be no doubt that if Eugene Prime won the seat, that Labour's representation would go up from 32 to 33. It's a very interesting situation that a lot of people think that, you know, the party vote numbers at the general election in September determine the numbers for the rest of the life of Parliament. That's not the case, because if a party loses a seat in an electorate, the only way of replacing an electorate seat is through a by-election. Of course, if you lose a list member dies, retires, resigns, then the party gets the right to replace it. So we do have by-elections. It's interesting to consider that, you know, a lot of European countries with proportional representation don't have by-elections. And it's something in some ways New Zealand should have considered. You know, one way of ensuring government stability is to say, well, for the life of the parliament, there are no by-elections. Electorate MPs are replaced by list candidates as well as list MPs. But of course, we haven't gone that route. We've decided to have by-elections so governments could lose their majorities. In this case, it doesn't have a majority. It does have a majority with a confidence and supply coalition type agreement, and that would really remain the same. Although on individual pieces of legislation, that's where it does get fascinating. And it, quite clearly, the government is hoping to amend the Resource Management Act in this session of Parliament, and a lot in that case is going to depend on the Northland by-election.
And in either scenario, an opposition party winning the seat, or National winning the seat, would there still be an overhang in Parliament of one seat?
Yes. Yeah. The overhang in Parliament comes about because Peter Dunne won his electorate, or Horiu, and therefore because he won his electorate, MMP says, right, the party votes won by your party go into the formula to determine the number of seats in Parliament. But United Future didn't have enough party votes to qualify for even one seat in Parliament. Their number of party votes, 5,000 plus, wasn't anywhere near the 120th highest quotient that you get under the formula for distributing seats under MMP. So that overhang would remain. It's going to remain a Parliament of 121.
And what if National hadn't stood aside in Oahu or in Epsom for Peter Dunne and David Seymour, respectively? What would be the situation there for National?
Well, that's one of the fascinating things, to look at the election results, because National did deals, nods and winks, to the electors of Epsom and Oahu, and in the hope that it would actually shore up a national government. And, of course, it has, in the sense that National, with 60 seats, can't govern alone in a parliament of either 120 or 121. You still need 61 seats. National said, whew, OK, we've got David Seymour, we've got Peter Dunne, we've got confidence and supply agreements with them. But the interesting thing is that if you just recalculate the results of the last election, but say that those two MPs, David Seymour and Peter Dunne, had not won their seats, then National would have won 61 seats in a parliament of 120. There wouldn't have been an overhang because Peter Dunne wouldn't have won his seat by definition, and it wouldn't have mattered who won the seat. If Labour or National had won either seat, and of course Labour came second in Oahu, National came second in Epsom. You know, say those two parties had won the seats, their total number of seats would have been determined by the absolute number of party votes that they won. So ironically, National's trying to game the system. The nods and winks to the electors in those two electorates actually, ironically, denied National an absolute majority in Parliament.
Nigel Roberts, Professor Emeritus at Victoria University. Still on elections, the Parliamentary Library has published a paper covering virtually everything you could possibly want to know about the last election in September. It's available from Parliament's webpage, www.parliament.nz, under Research Papers. And submissions to the Government Administration Committee's inquiry into the 2014 general election have to be in by Tuesday, March the 31st. While the Privileges Committee is calling for submissions on its inquiry into the use of social media in parliamentary reporting to be in by Friday, April the 10th. and you have until Thursday, March the 26th, to make submissions on the Coroner's Amendment Bill, which is with the Justice and Electoral Committee. Submissions may be made online, and you can find out more about that from Parliament's webpage.
Thanks, Tom. And now we go to the debating chamber for question time on Tuesday.
Question number one, Andrew Little.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and asks, does he stand by his comment that, quote, no one's arguing that we're not working as fast as we possibly can, end quote, to cut ACC levies, given ACC, the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, Treasury, the Employers and Manufacturers Association and Infometrics are among those recommending bigger cuts?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I stand by my full statement in the interview, which included, so we've cut over $1 billion in levies so far and we're on track to cut more. We did tidy up the mess we inherited from Labor. That was certainly true. But if you look at it in the early days, we were first in government. ACC wanted to massively increase their levies. They wanted to take them through the roof. And as the Cabinet, we said, well, no, I don't think that makes sense. So there's often the differential between what ACC think and what we can afford.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Given it's affordable and it's what ACC wants, why not cut levies by $350 million a year now rather than vague promises to cut them in the future with no time frame?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government receives a recommendation on levy increases or reductions from ACC and then makes a decision based on what it thinks is appropriate. In fact, actually, it's not. Well, actually, yes, it is wrong sometimes. So just to give you an example, in 2010-11, ACC wanted to increase levies by $1.137 billion more than what the Cabinet approved. In 2011-12, it wanted to increase them by $165 million more. In fact, if you look at the time that we've been in office, ACC have wanted to increase levies by $1.302 billion more than the Cabinet approved, and it's reduced them by $673 million less. Actually, the Cabinet does use discretion, and thank goodness it does.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Is he aware that his overcharging of ACC levies will see ACC add hundreds of millions of dollars a year to reserves that are already well in excess of what it needs? And why shouldn't that money stay with businesses and workers instead?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
I don't think that's right. The government has cut $1 billion from ACC levies so far. It has a $500 million cut planned. We take the best advice and information that we can and assess things. But, Mr. Speaker, while I wouldn't want to get ahead of the next levy setting process, indications are that the overall liability might in fact increase slightly over last year. And in fact, the Cabinet being slightly more prudent about its actions will prove to be the right one.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Given that his previous ACC minister said ACC's call to cut levies was ignored, quotes, because we need to get to surplus, end quotes, why is it government policy to use ACC levies, which are meant for helping injured Kiwis, to fill the hole in his budget?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, it's not. It's one of the factors that we know flows through to the overall, just one of many. But the Cabinet makes a decision largely based on what it thinks is affordable and trying to smooth things out. As I said earlier, ACC wanted to increase those levies in 1 year alone by $1.137 billion more than what the Cabinet approved. The reality is the member can't have it both ways. He can't say on the one hand he doesn't want levies to go up when that's what ACC recommends, and he does want levies to go down faster when that's what ACC recommends. Either he's a slave to them or he's not.
Supplementary question, Tim McIntyre.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What reports has the Prime Minister received calling for the government of the time to ignore the ACC board's recommendations on ACC levies?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, fascinatingly enough, I've seen a report from October 2009 arguing strongly that the government should utterly reject the ACC board levy recommendations. Those comments came in a media release issued by the then EPMU National Secretary, Mr. Andrew Little, which shows you can't reject the board's recommendations 1 year and apparently be a slave to their recommendations another.
Order. Order. Question number four, Jonathan Young.
My question is to the Minister of Transport and asks, what update can he give on government investment in bridge infrastructure in Northland?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Simon
Bridges. Mr. Speaker, the government is committed to ensuring that Northland has the infrastructure and the services it needs and deserves. So I know there's a lot of excitement about this, Mr. Speaker. That is why yesterday I was proud to be part of an announcement with the National Party's Northland candidate, Mark Osborne, committing to replace 10 single-lane bridges.
Order. This is the last time I'm going to rise to my feet and ask members to my left-hand side to quieten down. Next time I'll be asking a noisy member to leave the chamber. This is a question that's been asked. It requires an answer, and I want to be able to hear the answer. That is the last warning I will give to my left-hand side today. Honourable Simon Bridges.
Mr. Speaker, I was proud to be part of an announcement with National's Northland candidate Mark Osborne yesterday, committing to replace 10 single-lane bridges on Northland's Twin Coast Highway over the next 6 years. This is an excellent commitment for the North. Mr. Osborne deserves credit for advocating this. This is a party that is enabling economic growth in the North. Unlike others, the government has and will continue to back Northland to succeed.
Supplementary question, Jonathan Young.
How much has been committed to the upgrading of the 10 bridges and what are the expected benefits?
Speaker.
Honourable Simon Bridges.
You go back to deal-making, Andrew. Mr. Order. Speaker, the government wants to ensure Northland is ready for the influx of visitors and businesses that will come off the Pūhoi to Wellsford Highway and on to the Twin Coast Highway. That's why we are committed to the next logical step, spending between $32 and $69 million to replace 10 single-lane bridges on those Twin Coast Highways with modern two-lane bridges that are fit for purpose. This investment will make sure Northland has safer and more resilient roads and bridges that will enable the region to take increased freight coming out of the region as well as increased tourist traffic Order. Across the region. I repeat, this is a party that backs the regions, unlike the latte-sipping St Mary's Bay folk over the other side.
Supplementary question, Phil Twyford.
What reports has the Minister seen on the transportation of pigs in Northland? And does he have any figures showing the amount of additional pork that these new bridges will take to market?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Simon Bridges.
Mr. Speaker, the member shouldn't talk about his colleagues in that way. But, Mr. Speaker, frankly, this is something that the people of North don't see in that way. They think that it's important for their region. I saw with my firsthand with my own eyes the safety issues of these single-lane bridges, the way they are a lifeline to communities when flooding comes, they can't access emergency services, and the way that double-laning them and improving them will enable economic growth for many years to come in a region that this side backs while the others ignored it.
Supplementary question, Jonathan Young.
How much money has the government invested in state highway and local roading projects across Northland?
Honourable
Mr. Speaker.
Order. Honourable Simon Bridges.
Heaps. Mr. Speaker, this National-led government has invested $750 million in state highway and local roading projects across the North, while some 40% more than Labor did in the same equivalent period. And that doesn't include Pūhoi to Wellsford, a $1.75 billion project that this government, unlike the others who call it a holiday highway, will promote. Mr. Speaker, yesterday's announcement shows that the National-led government is committed to making sure that Northland succeeds and is the only one offering the level of investment in first-world infrastructure to ensure Northland delivers on its abundant potential.
Question number 9, Eugenie Sage.
Tanakwe, Mr Speaker, thank you. For the environment and asks, will he be taking any steps to increase protection for Indigenous trees and vegetation in the proposed changes to the Resource Management Act?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, the Resource Management Act already provides ample opportunities for councils to be able to protect Indigenous trees and vegetation, so no. The law gives councils discretion over whether they wish to protect individual trees or groups of trees, and where they are protected, as in the Kauri case in the Waitakeries, whether to grant consent for alteration or removal. The situation with trees does vary hugely from community to community, and it is entirely appropriate that the Act gives council discretion over what trees to protect and where they are protected, when to grant consent for their approval. It's healthy that there is debate around how councils administer that discretion, but it's not a fault with the law.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Eugenie Sage.
Does he see the Auckland Council's decision to allow a developer to fell centuries-old kauri and rimu trees as striking the correct balance between landholder rights and the environment?
Speaker.
Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, the Resource Management Act gives councils the discretion to decide whether trees should be protected. The group of trees in the Waitakere Ranges was included in the district plan and in the draft unitary plan that's currently before the panel for protection. The council commissioned a 70-page report on the individual case, and it decided that the tree would be granted consent to remove. That's a decision for council.
Supplementary question, Eugenie Sage.
If this 500-year-old kauri is not protected under the RMA as it stands, how can he justify strengthening landholder property rights and weakening the RMA's environmental safeguards as he proposes?
Oh, Mr Speaker.
Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, there are hundreds of cases of trees that come before councils every year. I'm all the time hearing the case put by the Green Party that you should let councils make decisions. Council's made a decision that there is a healthy debate about, but it's a decision that rests with the Auckland City Council.
Green.
Supplementary question, Eugenie Sage.
Does he believe that felling this 500-year-old kauri is acceptable when less than 1% of old-growth kauri forest remains? And if not, will he commit to a national policy statement on Indigenous biodiversity to guide councils in their implementation of their statutory responsibility to protect biodiversity?
Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, I'm not convinced that a national policy statement under the RMA would have a significant effect on such a discretionary decision. The reality is that councils have to make those trade-offs as to where to protect trees and where allow them to be felled. If there is a particular instance, in this case I'm surprised, it is the decision by the Auckland Council not to notify the decision. The test under the law is that if the effect is less than minor, they don't have to notify it. I would have thought the loss of a, and I'm advised it's about a 200-year-old kauri, I am surprised by the decision not to notify a decision to remove a 200-year-old kauri.
Thanks, Tom. And what's coming up this week in the House?
Well, the government's expected to put the House under urgency at some point to pass a bill setting aside the Remuneration Authority's decision giving MPs a 5.5% pay rise. And that's in a week in which it's one government bill after another, with an hour on Wednesday set aside for the weekly general debate. Among new bills due for a first reading are the Weathertight Homes Resolution Services Amendment Bill, while the Human Rights Amendment Bill is coming up for its second reading. And right below it on the order paper is the Radio New Zealand Amendment Bill, also ready for a second reading, suddenly promoted, though, up 20 places to be on the doorstep of the debating chamber at number 7. It's been parked waiting for a second reading since December 2009. That's just over 5 years, so it'll be interesting to see if there's any special reason for its sudden elevation.
Tom Frewen. And you can find more information and a podcast of this program on our webpage, Parliament Today or oneword.co.nz. I'm Hinea Ahu, and I'll be back with Tom Frewen and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.